Thank you for that introduction. And even though this is my first visit to Norway and I know very little Norwegian, I could sort of follow what Kim was saying. And I understand that I'm supposed to be talking about organization or clarity as opposed to anarchy, which is going to be tomorrow. But unfortunately, I'm going to be mentioning some anarchy in the organized world. And I think Kim mentioned some of the problems that this data still has. So what I'll do today is talk through some of the issues involved in creating and publishing identifiers. And I'll be doing that in the context of the linked data paradigm. I think I can use this. So for those of you who are not familiar with OCLC, we're based in Dublin, Ohio. This is a picture of our headquarters, and I work in that building. But since about the early 2000s, we have created offices throughout the world. There are 18 offices, and many of them are small, but one of them that is important to us and to the European community is based in Leiden, the Netherlands, and that was the old PICA organization, which we merged with in the early 2000s. And as you see there are lots of different countries represented, 1,200 staff members. Oops, sorry. So OCLC manages WorldCat, and that was the product that got us launched in the early 1960s. It went under a different name back then, but it was originally conceived of as a crowdsourcing project, although crowdsourcing was not invented as a term until many years later. And so the idea was that if librarians are creating bibliographic descriptions individually, there's a lot of duplicated effort. And a lot of good things would happen if we could collaborate on those descriptions. And so effort would be saved. You would have a central place where you would have a snapshot of the library holdings as a whole. And now that is called the collective collection. And WorldCat is an image of what that collection looks like. And so that can be used to create cooperative enterprises among libraries. Interlibrary loan was the original impetus for it, but now it's used for shared print. And the idea there is that many libraries have duplicate print collections and all libraries suffer from space limitations. And so shared print encompasses the idea that if you hold common holdings in a single place, then they can be accessed by multiple libraries, and you need a database to allow that to happen. So because WorldCat is a picture of the library collection as a whole, it makes sense that we would be interested in linked data, because that also enables us to create a data set that describes the library community as a whole. So in that context, we've been doing a lot of work with linked data since its inception, and some of my colleagues whose work I'll report on today were working on that initiative long before linked data was known to the rest of the community. So I work in OCLC research. My boss is Lorcan Dempsey, and the work that I'll be reporting on is a group contribution that I'm a member of, and we work at OCLC, and we work very collaboratively with members of the community as well. And so if you look at all of the people involved in these efforts, it's quite large, so probably numbering close to 100 people, but that's a guess. So what is linked data? I'm sure everyone here knows or has been familiar with that term before, but linked data is many things to many people now, And I think it's a popular term, and it's the subject of some hype. And just so that we have a common understanding, I'll present this page because I think it reflects some of the key concepts that linked data is about. First of all, it mentions that linked data is about structured data. And we know that as librarians that we've already been creating structured data for many years, since the beginning of the computer age for libraries, which is near the beginning of OCLC's tenure. But the structured data of linked data is different because it's meant to be understood outside the community that created it. So we create bibliographic descriptions using some sort of tagging scheme such as author and then the name of an author, title, the name of a title, and that can be expressed in multiple standards, and we saw some of those in Kim's presentation on one of his slides. But in linked data, we work with standard published vocabularies that can be understood not only within our community, but by major search engines who will be able to take our descriptions and broadcast them way beyond the library community, where we'll meet more users and more members of other communities who might be interested in published materials. So the other thing that's important about this is that linked data is about semantic querying or semantic understanding. And so ultimately, what you're trying to do is create knowledge bases of the things that are of interest to you. And you query that knowledge base through semantically meaningful inquiry. So an example of that, we can already see that it's partially used in modern Google interfaces. And they're both it's illustrated on a slide like this, but this is a typical search, and you can query other issue other queries to Google to see something similar. So on the left-hand side, a person who has typed in the term Chicago, big city in the U.S., might find a list of documents like that. And it's what Google is literally returning there is a list of documents that contains that string Chicago, and that list is ranked in terms of popularity. How many things link to those documents? Those documents will be at the top of the list. But what it doesn't do is that semantic thing that the user probably intended. So that's what the user probably wanted was information about something named Chicago. And so on the right-hand side, Google has guessed that thing named Chicago that the person is probably interested in is the city Chicago. And by creating a structured knowledge base from data that it mines from the web and the data that is understandable to Google because it's published in a format that is shared among communities, Google can put together a structured display that describes Chicago, the city, describes points of interest within the city, maps within the city to those places. And then once you click on those places, you'll see other knowledge cards that tell you other information, such as hours of operation, or if it's a place that hosts events, you can order tickets and that sort of thing. And so those are the two different views of web searching that we have now. The older one, the web of documents, the newer one, the web of data, which is this integrated collection of facts or a knowledge structure or what Google calls a knowledge vault from which you can display, create applications that show meaningful data. So just another example, if you're interested not in Chicago the city, but Chicago the band, you can come up with a list of documents that contain Chicago and band. And in this case, you see a fairly good set of examples of Chicago the band, but this is probably accidental. But on the right-hand side, you see another knowledge card that shows you things about Chicago, the band, record albums, and things like that might be of interest. So the web of data is what we want to be able to contribute to when we're contributing to linked data, when we publish linked data. So what does this have to do with the library community? Well, it turns out that the key pieces that you need in your data model are actually already there in some form, and we've been doing this for a long time. It's called authority control. And so what we do with authority control is identify those things that are of interest to us, all of the authors of books, the books themselves, the subjects of those books, and we connect them in various ways, and so that we know that Albert Einstein is the author of the book Relativity, the Special and General Theory, and that book is about physics, roughly. And so if you think carefully and introspect on what you're doing when you say that, you're creating sentences, and the sentences have a subject, a relationship, and an object. So in linked data terms, those are called triples, and those are expressed as RDF. And so that's what we will eventually be able to do with this data, but it is already there in some form in these old authority files. And so what do we do in order to get to linked data then? Well, one way to get to it is to do a slight technical upgrade and say that we want to look at these authority files and expand them to mean entity hubs or authoritative hubs about entities. And I'll describe a little bit later why that expansion is a little bit necessary. It is necessary. The second thing you want to do is to take the description within that hub and make sure that there is a persistent identifier to it. And so those are called URIs, and those are in blue on the screen. And then once you have that, then you can publish RDF that is understandable outside the community that we work in and is more reliable inside the community that we work in, because the URLs should be more stable. So from this slide, then, you can see the triples that might be described. So you have the person who is referred to by the VOF ID that's shown there is the author of the work ID that is shown there. And in addition to that, many of the entities that we care about in our world are also interesting outside our world. And so in this example, Albert Einstein is also described in Wikidata. And I noticed that in one of Kim's slides that insight has already been spread far and wide. And so when we are interested in an author, for example, we have to collect URIs for that person from all over the place. But once we do that, we have a description that is possibly much more rich than anything that we alone can publish ourselves. So before we move on, I want to drill down a little bit into what exactly is meant by an identifier. And I believe that identifier is not clearly defined, because it has meant different things over time. And in this world, there's an evolution that you can sort of trace with evidence. And so as this image suggests, there's a core piece that gets translated into these different formats. But when that happens, the meaning changes slightly. So at the beginning, if you look at an authority file, an ID is a database record ID or an authority control number. That can then get translated into a URL, which is a location for a document on the web, which would happen when the authority file is published on the web and you need to access the ID for a given person or work. And in the internet world, or in the linked data world, we now have URIs, which is something a little bit different. As the linked data people try to define it, a URI is persistent and it's globally unique, and when you dereference it, it refers to a thing, not a document. Now, I should say, too, that URI and URL have been around since the early 90s, since the beginning of the web, but I would say also that in the linked data world, the URI has acquired this specialized meaning. So just to give a quick example, if we look at the American author Ernest Hemingway, who wrote The Old Man and the Sea, For Whom the Bell Tolls, many classic works of literary fiction from the early 20th century, you can walk through these examples. So originally, we have a database record ID. And in one example, we have a Library of Congress control number, and that's the number there. And that is the source of the heading for Hemingway Ernest, 1899 through 1961. So that's the authoritative location of that. And you can put a Library of Congress control number directly in a bibliographic record, and that's the way we've written bibliographic records for many, many years. And so in the late 1990s, I believe, the Library of Congress published the Library of Congress authority files as web documents and gave all of them URLs. And so the URL for the description of Ernest Hemingway is shown there. Notice, though, that database record ID becomes a token in the URL, and so there is a relationship back to the legacy form. Recently, though, within the past 5 or 6 years, the Library of Congress has been publishing URIs. And so one of the first URIs is the one shown third in the list, which is a linked data version of the Library of Congress authority files in which Ernest Hemingway and the other elements of that authority file are modeled as concepts. And so that refers to this concept of Ernest Hemingway as the author of a book. And more recently, just this year, in fact, the Library of Congress has published a different URI, which says that we want to refer to the person Ernest Hemingway. And notice here that in the URI token we have RWO, which refers to real-world object, which is a hugely important concept in the semantic web, which is also very difficult to define, but we can sort of agree that Ernest Hemingway is a real person. So what this says is that there's this person, Ernest Hemingway, and he was real, and a description of him can be found at that URI. Notice that it carries along that database ID. And in the real-world object description that you can access from the Library of Congress, it'll say that he is described further at the URI above. So you can find more information about him in the authority file. And there's a semantic distinction. So the person URI gives birth and death dates and other relationships. The concept URI is more about maintaining the heading and the different forms and where the different forms came from and when they were modified and that sort of thing. And so this is very tricky stuff. And I think when you talk about what an identifier is, it could mean any of those things. But it starts with the authority file. And so when we talk about identifiers in the linked data world, what we say is that the ultimate expression, the most modern expression of an identifier is the URI. And the URL and the database record ID are actually legacies. And so that's why we need to talk about this in the context of linked data, because not all URIs may be or not all identifiers may be in linked data yet, but they're headed in that direction. And so we need to take into account that that's where things are going. So I'll give you a little bit more context here. And this is in the context of a recent survey that we did of linked data users. This is work that was conducted by my colleague Karen Smith Yoshimura, and she reported on it at a conference in the U.S. a couple of months ago. I have a link at the end to that report, and it also has the raw data, which is a spreadsheet. It's very interesting stuff. If you're interested in this world at all, I suggest that you look at this because there's a lot of information. And that's because 90 participants answered the survey, and many of those participants had multiple linked data projects. In addition to that, they were asked which linked data projects are you interested in, even if you're not publishing the work yourselves, and so we got many more links. And so this ends up being a corpus of the linked data usage and interest in our community, and there are probably 120, 130 links, and it's very informative to look through all of them. So in the interest of time, I can only summarize some things, but again, I would encourage you to look at the raw data. So there is a large geographic breakdown. Lots of countries are represented there. This is an international movement. In the United States, this is important. This is important because the Library of Congress has declared that this is the direction that we're moving in. And I believe that many national libraries in Europe have made the same decision. So Norway is mentioned in there. So looking at them by type, we can see that over half of them are academic and national libraries, but a smattering of other kinds of institutions. And so networks would include OCLC and BIBSIS is in there. Many government agencies in Europe responded, including the Defense Ministry in Spain. A public library, Oslo Public Library, is mentioned in there. And then scholarly societies and museums are maybe slightly less represented. So what is published as linked data? This slide gives you some examples of the types of information that gets published as linked data. And you can infer from this something about the maturity of the field, where things stand right now. And so you can see that the vast majority of the things that are published as linked data are bibliographic data, authority files, descriptive metadata, and things about digital collections. And so there's a lot of interest in that type of stuff. And an example of that is Europeana. It is a really high-profile project in that space. But what you also notice is that there's quite a bit of attention given to ontologies and vocabularies. And there you can mention some projects that are important in the United States. For example, the Library of Congress work. So we have the Library of Congress authority files. We also have an attempt to describe bibliographic items. So that tells you that work is happening at a foundational level on those kinds of things. So these are the resources most consumed. VIOF, the ones in light blue, are OCLC's offerings. The others are, a couple of others are outside our community, but notice that there are contributions from European libraries, even in a very short list of the most consumed resources. So a couple of examples. The British National Bibliography was one of the first published data sets of bibliographic materials. This was hugely influential, and it's now part of the British National Data Infrastructure. The Digital Public Library of America is a fairly recent project, but it has received a lot of grant funding and support from major university and public libraries. It was inspired, I believe, by the work that was done in Europeana, where it was obvious that Europe has a big leg up on collecting digitized materials, and that the bibliographic field is a a little bit on what we have experienced at OCLC as we're doing linked data identifiers, publishing identifiers. So the story starts here. An influential group that was convened in 2011, the Library Linked Data Incubator Group, a World Wide Web consortium project. And that list of authors is... Is this on? Can you hear? Good. Okay. Sorry about that. So the list of authors there is a who's who of the early adopters of linked data. So thought leaders. My colleague Jeff Young is in that group. My former colleague Michael Panzer, who was the Dewey Decimal Classification editor in chief until recently. A professor that's in my local community, Marcia Zhang. These people have presented a lot at conferences. You may have heard their names. So what did they discover? Well, they discovered, first of all, what they reported here was that if you look at what linked data offers for data publishers, there are huge advantages. So this is sort of an informal graph that says as you move right, there's greater conformance to linked data principles. And as you move up, you'll see perceived data benefits. And so those boxes on the left, you could imagine implementing them in ways other than linked data, you know, finding ways to integrate data or manage data. URLs are easier to manage than strings, for example. But once you get into the upper right-hand corner, you start to think about the benefits that can really be achieved only with linked data as we understand it now. So you can share the cost of description. If you can link descriptions that are produced by multiple parties into the same description, you end up with something richer and more comprehensive and easier to maintain than a description that you've created entirely by yourself. And by doing that, by linking to Wikipedia or to DBpedia or to GeoNames or to other music brains and all of these resources that we already saw in one of Kim's slides, you can begin to realize that that description is going to be broadcast far beyond the library community. So users will come to Wikipedia or music brains and find descriptions that will lead them back to libraries. And so in terms that we like to use, we're bringing the library to the web closer to where the users are so that they can discover information about that can be found in libraries and make libraries more usable to them. And so that's one of the huge benefits of linked data, and that's one of the primary motivations for why we're involved in it. So in doing publishing, there are two big tasks that you have to address. One is to try to get the value out of legacy descriptions as much as you can. And I'll talk a few minutes about that. So again, going back to this chart, what would you do in this space? One is that you're really just doing format conversion, one-to-one mapping. This term that's published over here means the same as this term that's published over here. And that kind of thing has been going on for a long time, even before linked data was a reality. And so what do you get out of that? What you're trying to do is to do this one-to-one mapping so that you get these strings out of that legacy format into something that looks like a thing, which you can then publish a URI for. And the outcomes for the amount of effort that you're putting into this are considerable. First of all, you don't really have to think about the ontologies because you use the ontologies that are already there. So you've got a low-cost start to that. A second thing is that this is all still new stuff, and so you need to worry about whether the conversion tools work, whether the ontology tools work, whether the triple stores work, whether you can query the triple stores in real time. And so there's a lot of technical assessment that's going on at the time. And you're testing those current ontologies. You're throwing interesting questions at them as you work. And as you do this, you're making a sort of small break from the past. And so you're already getting on that road to true linked data and the semantic web. And so the key project, the seminal paper here, and I'm sure this is one that everyone in this room has read, this was presented at the Dublin Core Conference in 2008 in Berlin. And it was a study by the Library of Congress, led by Ed Summers, plus Antoine Isaac, who is well known in the European data model and linked data community. And they looked at what it would take to convert the Library of Congress subject headings into linked data using the SCoS ontology. And they also did a lot of technical assessment to show that, yes, you can do this at scale. Yes, it can be a mechanical process. And so what this consisted of was a bunch of mappings. So you had all of these MARC fields and then all of these SCoS concepts that they would get mapped to. And so if you read that paper and understood what they were saying, you could identify a mechanical process that you could apply to your own data, which is what we did a few years later when we converted FAST to linked data. So FAST is a simplified version of the Library of Congress subject headings. And so that's a FAST, or MARC authority file with the typical terms. That is the linked data version of it, a human-readable version. And you can see that there is a one-to-one mapping. So there you have the database ID that's now part of a URI. There you have the preferred term in the MARC field is now a preferred label in SCoS, and so on. And as we've noted before with Ernest Hemingway, one problem, though, is that if it's modeled in SCoS, it's going to be modeled as a concept. So you're not modeling the bear, the thing that's scary on a hike, but you're modeling the concept of a bear who might be in a subject heading somewhere. And so that's a first draft version of a linked data project. So in that 2011 W3C report, it was concluded that this process of converting authority files to linked data was well understood, and there were a lot of successes already stemming primarily from the work that the Library of Congress did. But bibliographic data was much harder because the standard is bigger. It's not clear what you should focus on. And so that became a call to action as a result of that report. And so in the ensuing years, that's been happening. So just an example here. So this is a WorldCat record for a science fiction article, a science fiction book, well-known book. And as with other records in WorldCat, you can get to the linked data that we produce by scrolling down to the bottom of the page. And as we worked on this, we saw that there were multiple proposals for how to do the linked data. So here are some examples. We have the British Library data model, which combined concepts from different schemes, so mostly Dublin Core, Bebo, some locally coined URIs. We used schema.org because we were interested in access to the internet, and so we would take something like the British Library data model and map everything to schema.org and see how we did. Meanwhile, BibFrame is doing the same thing. They're creating their own ontology, and they have their own correspondences. But roughly, this is a set of mappings from a title in one ontology to a title in another, language creator, and all of those other things. And so in the end, though, you end up with something that is roughly as descriptive as a Dublin Core record. And I would say here that that is an example of the maturity of the field. It's not a final point at all. And so I think you guys have read this paper from corresponding with Kim. I got that impression. So in putting all of this together, we said that there is an overlap between an ontology that is expressed in schema.org and BibFrame, because they both have this Dublin Core-like coverage. But an ontology that is for a specialized domain is obviously going to be much richer, even though it's theoretical at this point. That has advanced a little bit in 2016, because a group at the Library of Congress has taken the time to model a complex object that would be a film, for example, a film with lots of contributors and creators, and then all of the physical aspects of the materials that it's published on. And so in order to produce all of that, it's going to go way beyond what Schema does, and as they argue, beyond what BibFrame does, and you end up with a three-tiered model. But if you look at where everything comes from, there are either implicit or explicit mappings from all of these different schemas here. So schema.org was influenced by these ontologies plus others. BibFrame is inspired by a different set of ontologies that overlap, and so on. And so if you look at what each of these tiers is meant to do, though, there are use cases that go with each one. So Schema is for search engine discovery, BibFrame is for OPAC discovery, and the AV model, which has the physical metadata of the carrier, is for curation for film librarians. And so you can see that just by doing mapping and using existing ontologies, that this gets quite complex very fast. And we're not done yet. This is still theoretical, and it's still based on an earlier version of BibFrame and hasn't been updated to the latest version. So in this stage, what do we need to do here? This is actually far trickier than we would have thought originally, because there's a whole bunch of stuff that you have to get right. So you have to identify the right things in your space. And if you're mapping from one concept to the next, it's easy to get lost in minor details or get lost in the weeds. But to find that important thing that you need to solve in your domain, and I think in our domain, that important thing that you need to solve is to connect the user to the work that they want, and to describe the author's relationships to those works. So how do you do all of that when you're mapping at a very low level? It's easy to get lost. A second thing that's important is that when you have a string in legacy data and you're trying to map that to a thing, you have to interpret what that string refers to. So you're asking the data a question that may not have occurred to the people who created the data. So one example is all of these legacy identifiers. And so things like ISBNs, OCLC numbers, other local numbers, we all have them in our systems. What do they refer to? It's hard to say, because that question wasn't asked when the data was created. So with an ISBN, you can say, well, that refers to a Ferber manifestation. But then there are publishers who reuse ISBNs, and so maybe it doesn't refer to anything. What does an OCLC number refer to? Well, we can say that it refers to a manifestation. But in an aggregation of data, there are multiple OCLC numbers for the same manifestation. And so this gets very tricky. And this is why people looking even at this simple stuff begin to feel pessimistic that if all you're doing is mapping, you are locked in this legacy that is trapping you from doing what the data really wants you to do. And so I suspect that that's one reason why some libraries are already deciding that the legacy can stay where it is, and we're going to contribute all of our innovation to the new thing. And so that is a tough thing to do. And if we don't do this right, you might end up creating this rusty, creaky infrastructure that will have to be decommissioned and rebuilt many years later. So that's an old historic steelworks in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. So the next step, once we've done all this mapping, gotten everything we can get out of the old legacy system, is that we have to build these entity hubs, these modern authority files. And so again, going back to this chart, there are some various things we can do that don't necessarily require linked data. So you're aggregating evidence, you're establishing some references, you're evaluating the quality and truthfulness of the data. And we do this anyway. You know, we did this, we aggregated data before there was linked data, and we had to do all of this. But what we're trying to do, if we think about this in the linked data sense, is that we're trying to resolve URIs to the same entity. And we wouldn't have known to ask that question unless we were in the linked data paradigm. And so the outcomes here are actually much more radical. So we end up with this knowledge base, this network of things that is different, fundamentally different from the
aggregation of bibliographic records. We have a resource that can be integrated outside the context that created it. We have this thing that news organizations, scholars, hobbyists, people who are interested in the life of the mind, no matter where they're coming from, should be able to get to and understand part of it. Then we also have this very radical break with the past, not only because we have this thing that is structurally different, but because we're in a period of anarchy right now where our old standards are going to be going away. MARC is going to be retired, and linked data is going to replace it. That is a declaration from the Library of Congress, at least, and from many European libraries. And so if you're aggregating data like OCLC does, what do you aggregate against? You don't cluster MARC records anymore. You have to aggregate something else. And so what you're aggregating are against entities. So you're collecting clusters of information about all of these things that are of interest to you. And I would say, too, that for many people, many groups that are involved in linked data, they are primarily focused on that first task and not the second task. There are relatively few people who are working on the second task. But we know that we need this, and we've known this for a long time. So here's an example. This is a clip from some linked data that's been published on WorldCat, and it's a list of subject headings, basically. And if you look at it, we have a URI for a Dewey concept. We have a URI for a FAST heading. But most of what's there are what we call locally coined URIs, which means that the source data from that is an uncontrolled heading of some sort. We know it's a subject heading, but we don't know where it came from. And so we have this URI, which we're calling experimentworldcat.org, and then it's a topic, and then it's got an ID in it. But this is what we're getting. We're getting these strings, and we don't know how to convert those to things. And so if we have these locally coined URIs, these are no better for us than the strings are, because we still don't know what they mean. We still don't know what they refer to. So this is why we need to do aggregation, so that we can take data like this and merge it with other data where we might have the URIs associated with it. So in this particular record, we might have an uncontrolled heading for United States, but in another record, there might be a source of control for it, and we would merge that data. So that's the type of stuff that needs to happen when we do aggregation to upgrade the quality and create a knowledge base out of our original legacy data. So I would say our premier example of an entity hub is VOF, and it started out in the legacy world. But now published as linked data, Noam Chomsky has a URI. He's modeled as a person. There are multiple ways of representing his names, the traditional library data. We have links out to other library authority files and stuff that is published outside the library community, such as Wikidata. And altogether, we have identifiers in all of these different places. So VOF, WorldCat Works, is a data mining operation that produced URIs for Works. That's still experimental. We have FAST, as I showed you already. We have ISNI, International Standard Name Identifier, where a lot of innovative work is happening right now. So what are we going to be doing next? Well, first of all, we're going from these authority files to something larger. So an example is illustrated here. We have Janet Smith, who's a Scottish book author. So in traditional VOF, we had a collection of all of her mentions in various name authority files. And in linked data VOF, we have an additional mention in Wikidata. But we have all of these other places where she's mentioned that are not aggregated into anything. And so we don't really have her identity resolved in all of those places. We don't know if that DBpedia Janet Smith is the same as these others. We have stuff that could be modeled in linked data, but it's not there yet in places like the Oxford Biography Index or uncontrolled local URIs, which all linked data projects are publishing. In addition, Janet Smith is a traditional book author, and that's what gets recorded in authority files. But there are lots of other people creating lots of other things that deserve to be authority controlled as well, and that's not even mentioned here at all. In fact, that's a large source of interest at OCLC and elsewhere, and we've recently published two reports. Again, the lead author was Karen Smith Yoshimura, but this was done in collaboration with a group of people who are working on this project at universities and national libraries. And so these had an international representation. So registering researchers and authority files, tracking researchers, trying to understand trying to create a better model of institutional identifiers and their relationships to authors. And I should say, too, it's a little bit too early to put up a slide about this, but there is a more improved model of person as author coming out of ISNI as well, and that's being led by the British Library and the Bibliothèque Nationale de France. So we're looking forward to seeing that work mature. So as we work through this, we notice that we have to move forward because there are these obvious gaps. In addition to the published monograph, we have researchers who have careers, and we need to track them throughout their careers while they're respecting their privacy. Tracking pseudonyms and collective names and personas, linking to third-party data sets. And with the creative work, we need to connect creators to works. We need to understand the model of format that users understand. We need to deliver those objects that users ask for, which is all the more important in the digital age, because if we don't deliver the right form, they're not going to be able to consume it. And then I think the most important one is to understand that model of work that cuts across all of this detail. What is it? Is it a citation? We don't know. But what we're aiming for is something very simple. We want entity hubs that represent all of those things. And right now we have a version of work that is still beta. Same with person. Organization is going to emerge out of the ISNI work. Concept is still a concept on the table. But as we do this, we realize that all of these things are some sort of authority control. And it says that authority control is more important in the linked data world than ever, because the scope of it has expanded through changes in librarianship. And there are more things being controlled. So authority control for events, authority control for the different kinds of works. So a work data set, a manifestation data set, and so on. Those could be things that could happen. And so in the end, though, and what I'd like to leave you with, is that in the linked data paradigm, we started with authority control, and we have this intellectual tradition that gives us a leg up, but now we need it more than ever.
Battery issue, I guess.
Thank you again.
Thank you
for a very interesting talk on what you're doing at OCLC and data and semantic web and everything.
I look forward to interacting with you throughout today and tomorrow.
Yeah, but we can probably start some interaction.
Couple of
right
questions.
Now, if there are questions for this presentation.
And I'll leave the presentation with you, and feel free to correspond later if you want.
I find what you're doing with works very interesting, because I think a lot of us is working with that in Norway right now, because that's kind of a missing piece altogether. And you touched upon it by the end of your presentation, that you need to sort of find the right conceptual granularity of the Ferber model, for instance. What are your stance on that by now?
Well, like a lot of groups working, we are looking at the possibility that Ferber is too complex, and we're trying to simplify it. And another issue with Ferber is that it breaks the link between what the user wants and how he gets it, because Ferber is a cluster, it has an effect of clustering things. And so an example in OCLC systems is that a person searches for something in WorldCat, and through clustering around the Ferber work, you get a general description, but then the description of the thing that is most accessible to the user in the location that the user is in is hard to get from that display. And so that's an example of where Ferber has possibly caused a problem. And the Library of Congress has also decided that in their simplification of Ferber in the BibFrame model. So we are very definitely questioning that, and in the process, asking questions about RDA as well.
Yeah, because now we have the second edition of BibFrame, and they keep the separation between a work and an instance, mm-hmm. a manifestation level sort of. But if you take a look to what they're doing in France and Spain, they are quite complex Ferberish models in their published linked data. And you could, of course, say that that is mappable, but it's mm-hmm. quite hard. Mm-hmm. And they have put a lot of work into those models and into publishing the data in that way.
Mm-hmm.
Should we put more thought into things before we publish, or should we keep the should we in Norway, for instance, just publish?
Well, I think what we talk about in our network is that there's an obviousness about linked data that might not have been evident in earlier forms of our data, which is that we're trying to model things. We're trying to model what is in the world. And so in some people's minds, that translates into just describe, be true to the thing that you're trying to describe. And the use cases for that are secondary. But as we get deeper into this, we realize, no, that's use cases are never going to go away. You need to know what the user is going to do with your data so that you know what details to capture in your model. And that's where the hard work is going to happen. And in that kind of hard work, you might realize that, yes, details that are in models like the complex realization of Ferber may need to be there after all.
Questions? Yeah.
Hi, Elisa Conradi from the National Library of Norway. I've understood that your work on works at OCLC has primarily been looking at legacy records and automating the process. Can you say anything about any future implications you think it your work will have on future cataloging? I mean, I'd imagine that once you find a model for how work should be described, it might influence how bibliographic descriptions will be later. Do you have any thoughts on that?
Yeah, we are thinking about that. And as far as the model of works goes, it is based on properties that a lot of people working in this project are working in this space understand to be content-oriented features. And so, for example, we know that a work has subjects, it has a title and authors and descriptions and tables of contents and those kinds of things. And that list of properties gets shared across institutions doing similar work. So we talk to the Library of Congress all the time to make sure that our algorithms for producing works are operating on the same kind of data that their algorithms for producing works work on. The problem, though, is that those algorithms work best for published monographs because that's where our best data is. But once you get beyond published monographs, then you have to start asking other questions. And then you might have to ask whether the legacy data even enables you to produce work-level descriptions algorithmically. And so, for example, the audio-visual data is very interesting and very immature. And so there's an article that I've written that should come out in a few months, I guess, that walks through what our published linked data tells you about a description of a movie and what is really there. And so it will have, as in our published monographs, it will have one reference to a work ID, when in fact the published movie might have four different works in it. It might have the movie itself, it might have the script for it. If it's a play, it would have the antecedent for that. And if the play is based on a literary work, it might have a description for that. So all of those are work IDs, and until you come up with a model that identifies that, then this algorithmic stuff is not going to get you far enough. And that's where I think the original cataloging is going to come in to help us get that right going forward, because we know that retrospectively we're not going to be able to get very far with it.
Thank you.
More questions? Okay, then I think we say thank you once more.
Thank you.